Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of July. What happened to aviator Amelia Earhart when she went missing over the South Pacific 75 years ago, this week, actually? There are a group of scientists and historians who think they might know, and they currently, right as we speak, they left on July 3rd, are going from Honolulu to a remote island in the Pacific nation of Kiribati in hopes of finding the wreckage of her Lockheed Electra plane in nearby waters. Actually, somebody from Kiribati had to be on the expedition, and they had to wait until Tuesday for him to arrive because there's only one plane a week that leaves from Kiribati to Honolulu. Joining us this hour to talk about Lady Lindy, who set aviation records, founded a pilots organization for women, was a member of the faculty at Purdue University, campaigned for women's rights, is the author of her biography, East to the Dawn is the name of the book, and Susan Butler is our guest. The life of Amelia Earhart, the basis also for the 2009 film Amelia. Well, welcome phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Susan, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. She is so fascinating to so many of us. And you have an interesting background because you have flying in your family, and you have flying back in the 30s where a lot of people were afraid to get into an airplane.
Absolutely true. My mother was one of the early pilots. She was a member of the 99s.
Isn't that something? And for those who aren't familiar, that organization is?
That is the organization of the first women pilots. The first 99 women who flew formed an organization, really. Amelia Earhart was the sort of founder of it, one of the four founders, but the first president. And they all needed to, they needed each other, because flying in those days was such a strange thing to do. And they gave each other a lot of help and a lot of publicity, of course, which also helped.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happened 75 years ago, and then we'll talk about her very rich life. She was only 39 years old. She was on a round-the-world flight when she went missing. Can you describe that flight?
Yes, that's right. And it was still, that was considered a very dangerous thing to do. Nobody had done it. She would have been the first. It's hard to sort of envision what flying was like in those days. Everything, just really flying, just getting into an airplane, was pretty dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And for her, it was an adventure, but what else motivated her to do this? Did she have a drive as a woman to be able to accomplish the thing that most people never thought could be accomplished?
Yes, she was very much, she protested and said, I am not a feminist, because she didn't really think that she was, but in fact, she was sort of the apotheosis of a feminist, and she got away with it. And she sort of charmed the world at the same time. Mm-hmm. What she wanted to do was show the world what women could do.
In compiling this book, tell me how you did this. You had journals, letters, you interviewed cousins, friends of hers?
Yes. I sort of eased into it, and I wrote the book over 10 years.
Wow.
And it was like a sort of a detective story. I just kept following leads, and one lead led to another, and I got very lucky, and I found a lot of material that nobody else had found, so I could flesh out her personality. And I found her a cousin that had never been interviewed by the name of Catch Chalice Pollock, and who had kept diaries of when they were growing up, and then had lived with her when she was famous, and I learned a great deal about Earhart that nobody had known.
And tell me more about that personality. How would you describe it?
Well, in the first place, she was charming. She was pretty, but not. She was sort of laid-back pretty in a sort of a simple way. I mean, she didn't wear a lot of makeup, but she curled her hair. It looked as if she had done nothing to it, but in fact, she took quite a bit of care of it. She was 5'8 and weighed 118 pounds. So she was she was a very sort of a very good looking woman who made everything look easy. So when she did something, she sort of tossed it off. She didn't make it a big deal of anything, and she wasn't sort of threatening when she accomplished something. She'd just say, "Oh well, I was lucky," or, "You know, this is how you do it, and any woman can do it, and all you have to do is sort of look up and try." And she was always sort of beckoning women to the next level.
How old was she, Susan, when she bought her first airplane?
She was 24.
Wow. She was young. And how did she happen to buy that? Where?
Well, she was out in California. She was living with her parents, and because flying was at that point, all planes were so fragile and they were all open, and people only flew on warm days when the sun was out, because otherwise they couldn't cope with the weather in open cockpit planes. And so the center of flying was, she was in Los Angeles, and that was sort of where the center of flying was, and she went to an air meet and she fell in love with flying. And then she determined to take, she started to take lessons. There was one woman out there by the name of Netta Snook that she found. She wanted to take a lesson from a woman because she thought it would be much easier. You know, men didn't think women in those days could do anything. And then she learned, and she didn't have a lot of money, but she bought a plane on time and worked very hard. At one point, she tried to be a telephone operator. She tried to do a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. She didn't have a very easy childhood, did she? Her father was an alcoholic.
Yeah,
he abandoned,
she had a very
family.
Tough childhood. Her father was an alcoholic. She'd been sent actually to live with her grandparents for a while, and that was wonderful. That was out in Atchison, Kansas, and that's where her young formative years were spent out in Atchison, Kansas with her parents. But then when she went to live with both of her, I mean, she lived there with her grandparents. And then when she lived with her parents, she had this catastrophe. The family had this catastrophe when her father became an alcoholic. And her mother and her sister, younger sister Muriel, and she left. And then for a few years lived in the utmost poverty in Chicago. And then eventually the family pulled itself together, and she was able to go to a good school, and her life changed. But there were some really, really terrible years for her as a young teenager.
Did she harbor a desire? I noticed at 1 year she was a pre-med student at Columbia University. Did she harbor a desire to be a physician at some point?
Oh, yes. She wanted to be a doctor. Hmm. Yes. She wanted very much to be a doctor. And she went, you're absolutely right, she enrolled at Columbia to be a doctor. But then she realized that she would never be able to have the funds to go to medical school. And so then she abandoned her idea. She didn't abandon the idea of getting an education. She decided she was going to be an engineer, and she took courses. She went back to Columbia and took courses in math courses to qualify to be an engineer, and then went to a Harvard summer school, taking a math course to make sure that her math requirements were up to snuff, and she applied to MIT, into their engineering school, and was actually turned down.
And how did she become, Susan, the first woman to cross the Atlantic? Was there a national search going on here? It wasn't.
Well, there sort of was. By that time, she was a social worker living in Boston. She was a social worker at a settlement house called Denison House. And it was the year after Lindbergh had flown the Atlantic. And there was a great race going on among women flyers and women who just wanted to become famous, to be the first woman to fly the Atlantic. And to be that first woman to fly the Atlantic, it didn't really make any difference if you were a pilot. strangely enough. Just to be a passenger would be enough. And a woman called Amy Guest, who was very wealthy, and actually a very interesting woman in her own right, decided she was going to be that first woman. And so she bought herself a plane, and she got herself, and then she got two pilots. The plane was a three-engine Fokker, which she bought from Admiral Byrd, and the best plane in the world for the job. And then she got the two top pilots. And then she was 55 at the time, and then she'd been doing this in secret. And then her family found out what she had in mind, and she had three almost grown children and a son about to take a law exam. He said, listen, if you think you're going to fly the Atlantic, I'm going to flunk my law exam because I certainly can't look at my books.
No, I can see why.
And she was a very interesting woman in her own right. And so she grudgingly said, well, okay, I won't do it, but then in my place you have to find a substitute who will be sort of a credit to American womanhood, an educated woman, and a flyer if possible. And then there was this magazine publisher, rather flamboyant magazine and book publisher by the name of George Palmer Putnam, and he heard about this. And he sort of assumed the control of interviewing to find this ideal of womanhood. And so he had a great friend by the name of Hilton Raley, who lived in Boston, and whom he had a great deal of confidence in. And so he told Hilton Raley that he should look in Boston and see if he could find anybody who would fit the bill to be the woman who would be on this plane. And the first person that Hilton Raley interviewed was Amelia Earhart, because she was a flyer. She'd had a little bit of publicity in Boston, and so she was probably the best-known flyer in Boston because she'd flown at a charity event. And she was also, by that time, a vice president of the National Aeronautics Association. So we called her up, and she answered the phone, and actually... she thought he was a bootlegger, so when he wasn't planning on telling her, actually, what he had in mind before the interview, but he said that she absolutely wouldn't meet him until he told her a little bit about what was going on. So he told her as much as she required, and then he met her, and he was absolutely, you know, fascinated by her. He thought she was just the perfect, fabulous female to fit the bill. So he set her on to George Palmer Putnam, and George Palmer Putnam, who at that point was in New York, also thought she would be perfect. So she was the only woman interviewed for the job.
And she kind of liked George Palmer Putnam as well.
Well, not at first. Not at first she didn't, no. At that point, she was still engaged to a man by the name of Sam Chapman. And George Palmer Putnam was married, and Amelia was a very moral woman. She wasn't thinking of, she just wasn't thinking of George Palmer Putnam in those terms.
So how did they wind up getting married, Susan?
Well, actually, as it turned out, in the first place, he flipped for her. And in the second place, his wife was having a very steamy affair.
Ah.
With somebody else. as she became friends with both of them, she realized it was a sort of it was a famous non-marriage of that time. Dorothy Minnie Putnam left George, and then George kept asking her to marry him, and she finally did.
So was the flight a big deal in the press? Was much made of the fact that the first woman was about to cross?
Oh, it was fantastic. In the first place, it's so hard to sort of grasp the fact that in those days, and it's not, 1920, it's 1920s, it's a long time ago, but there were huge sections of people who thought that if one was lifted into the air in an airplane, you were closer to God. Mm. It was just It was so different. People didn't realize what flying was. And then, of course, they were scared of that the engines would drop out, which, of course, they did. So it was, she was, the New York Times had hired her to write an article when she got to supposedly she was going to be in London. And they ended up in Buryport, Wales. But, I mean, she ended up in England, so they ended up in the right country.
well,
and that
good.
Was considered, nobody noticed that, I mean, the plane had originally, they thought was going to land in the Thames opposite the Houses of Parliament.
Right.
It was a seaplane. And and so she'd been hired for $10,000, which is a huge sum in those years, to write up the adventure for the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, among her competences, she was also a writer. She'd been writing for a Boston magazine before all of this happened. And so by the time she landed, she was such an efficient young woman that she had her article basically written. So she's sitting sort of twirling her thumbs when the plane lands in Buryport, Wales. And then by the time she gets to London, she gives in the article, and it's front page news all over the world.
Did she expect that? Was it really a surprise on her part when people started coming up to her after the flight? That she was the star of the trip. There were two other people on the plane.
They didn't even notice the pilots.
They didn't.
The guys.
Huh.
No. And no. She was stunned. She had actually taken a 2-week leave of absence from Denison House, and she expected to be back. And she was back there, and she was sort of a little worried that the summer program, because it was summer, the summer program wasn't going to be the same without her. She had no idea what was going to happen.
And look what happened. We're going to welcome phone calls. Susan Butler is our guest this hour, author of East to the Dawn, The Life of Amelia Earhart, which was the basis for the film Amelia. And we're talking about this today because as we speak, there is the Earhart Project is making an expedition from Honolulu to the island of Nikumaroro within the Republic of Kiribati, where they believe that her plane went down. There have been other expeditions. This is the most current one, and it's pretty elaborate. They have some fancy equipment that will allow them go to the depths of the ocean. So perhaps this time, and there have been some clues that that's where the plane may be. We'll talk to Susan about that expedition, and Susan's been on an expedition herself. So two questions. And more of this fascinating story. She is also, Amelia Earhart, the subject of a National Portrait Gallery exhibition, which is fairly new. And, of course, the Air and Space Museum has a whole room of Amelia Earhart. So it's a fascinating story that keeps fascinating us these many years later. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this day after the 4th of July. I think we were just looking for a great excuse to play a lot of songs and have some fun. We'll be talking about great summer songs, past and present. We have three music critics with us from the St. Petersburg Times, from Esquire magazine, and from Milwaukee's Shepherd Express. And we'll be talking about some of the songs of summer, going back to the Beach Boys all the way to, well, you know the song of 2012. You'll hear some of it. Two phone calls now. Susan Butler, author of East to the Dawn, The Life of Amelia Earhart, is our guest. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Jean in Oshkosh, our first caller. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Ms. Butler, I have a question.
Hope I can answer it.
My daughter and her family were stationed on Saipan for 8 years. And when you're driving from the airport towards the main mercantile locations and villages and things, There is a small rock hut with some. It seems to be secured, and both the Carolinians and the Chimuras contend, which are the native people, contend that the Japanese had incarcerated Amelia Earhart and possibly killed her there. Do you have any information on that?
Well, yes, I do. When I was writing the book, I interviewed a woman by the name of Fukiko Aoki, who had been a stringer. No, not a stringer. She was a bona fide reporter for Newsweek magazine. And she became interested in the Earhart story. This is in the 80s. And decided she was going to find out whether any of the stories were true that about Earhart being picked up and taken to Saipan and tortured, died. And so she interviewed every single person that had any story to tell, basically. She spent quite a bit of time on it and wrote a book, which unfortunately has never been translated. But anyway, I interviewed her. She's now living in the United States. And she said that that upon questioning, everyone who ever had said anything, who was quoted in any of the books, and of course there are many books that, about it, sort of got vaguer and vaguer and vaguer. And the stories just sort of disappeared into thin air. And her theory was that that there were obliging islanders originally who saw that if they could say anything about Earhart, these Westerners who came and questioned them were thrilled, and they became more important. And so they sort of inflated stories without any basis in fact. So I don't think that there's a shred of evidence, really, that the Japanese had anything to do with Earhart or that they had picked her up.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean, for the call. Now, Susan, you went on an expedition, didn't you? Can you talk about that?
I did, in 2009. You know, the question is where in on the ocean floor the plane rests. And so I was on an expedition. Seward Johnson was 204-foot boat, which had been chartered by Ted Waite, who actually was behind the movie Amelia. And he had two autonomous underwater subs commissioned, and they were aboard the Seward Johnson. And we left from American Samoa and went out to Howland Island and then spent 46 days. And these subs were sent down every day, and each one of them covered 24 square miles of the ocean floor. We were looking to the west of Howland Island because Ted Waite's theory, and which was also it's a very good theory, you have to decide whether you thought the plane was had come up short of Howland Island or whether it had overflown. So on the theory that headwinds had developed, we were looking on the western side. And the reason that the ocean floor has never been searched until this recently is that the ocean is 17,000 feet deep around Howland Island.
Woo.
Deeper, you know, than much deeper than where the Titanic or anything was has ever been found. So only recently has technology enabled us to send down these AUVs. Anyway, we searched the area to the west of Howland Island, and we didn't find the plane. And if the technology is so amazing that we had pictures of everything, including a 55-gallon steel drum. It's incredible what technology can do now. So I think, I mean, if the plane is not where Rick Gillespie thinks it is, and, I mean, I have no idea whether it is where he thinks it is, the next area to be searched will be the eastern side of Howland Island. the island where Tiger is now searching and where all the publicity is about is just over 300 miles from Howland Island.
Hmm. Do you have high hopes for this Tiger expedition?
Well, I always have high hopes, but
good.
But I mean, because as the biographer of me, I have this feeling that you know, when people are, some people think that she's only famous because of her because of the suddenness of her disappearance. But I think that when the remains of the plane are found, and by the way, the oceanographers tell me that the ocean is so deep that when it's found, the plane will be in the same position and look the same as it did when it went there.
Oh my!
Yeah, because there's no oxygen in the water at 17,000 feet, so the plane will not have rusted. But the thing is, I think that there'll be more emphasis placed on her life, and she'll be sort of more appreciated as the pioneer that she was. Because, I mean, I think she was just this extraordinary person. She accomplished so much, and she got away with it all, sort of.
Yes, she was an incredible person, wasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, and she had that. She had a light touch. It's very hard. It's very hard to be an adventurer and be a successful person and still keep that light touch.
Right. Let's go to Jim in Saukville. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I think Susan answered my question, how far off from the Howland Island is this new search area? I think you said 300 miles, roughly.
Yeah.
So she was, if that's true, she was really quite a bit off course. And, Susan, by the way, I met you down in Mountain Lake with Bill and Missy last winter.
Oh, hi.
What was going on down in Mountain Lake? Fill us in here.
That's where I live.
Oh, okay.
Oh, nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. Before we go back to phone calls, let's round out her life a little bit. I'm interested in her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt. I'm interested in the lectures that she gave around the country, her teaching at Purdue. What were her, other than aviation, which was first and foremost, what were the other issues that fueled her life?
Well, her life was very expensive. I mean, when she bought her first, her Lockheed Vega and all, and she supported herself by lecturing, because that's what the media was in those days. It was basically the lecture circuit.
Mm.
She was the most popular female lecturer, and she made her living that way. She bought her new planes that way for a number of years, and so that was her life. And she was the most popular lecturer in America.
And when it says she campaigned for women's rights, what rights specifically, Susan?
She didn't actually campaign for women's rights. She campaigned for women. And she eventually, although not right away, she even backed the Equal Rights Amendment for women. But she didn't go on doctrinaire speeches about women should have equal rights. She was more of the, she would talk about how women should become more educated, that women should give more to a marriage than their bodies, that they should develop their minds. She was always talking about the individual woman and what the individual woman could accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And was she close friends with Eleanor Roosevelt?
She was a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's, and I remember that I found out that Eleanor kept a photograph of her, and Eleanor admired her tremendously.
Did they fly together?
Yes, actually, Amelia took her up for her first airplane ride, and then, which was sort of a charming story, and got her to put her hands on the controls. And Eleanor actually had embarked on the idea of becoming a pilot, but then Franklin found out about it and said, "Forget it."
So this flight with her was a secret?
Well, it wasn't a secret. They were in Washington and at a dinner party, and after the dinner party, in the air arranged that there was a plane ready, and so in their evening dresses, she took Eleanor up on, in this plane, and Eleanor just fell in love with flying too, and actually took some measures to become a pilot. She took the physical exam.
She started to do stuff.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Huh. And how did Amelia feel about, you describe her as this kind of down-to-earth person who was heroic, really, and had all these interests and was quite accomplished. How did she deal with this instant celebrity status after that flight? What did she do with it? Was she overwhelmed by it? Did she take it in stride?
Well, she did take it in stride. And she sort of thrived on it, unlike Lindbergh, who fled to England. She took it, and she really used it for her own purposes, and her own purposes were to promote flying and to promote women, and that was what the world wanted to hear, was what she was saying. So it was sort of a perfect combination. So she went around the United States giving lectures to women's groups and various societies, pushing women and pushing flying.
And what about the impact that she had? How successful were her efforts on the lecture circuit and by her very actions in the air to improving the status of women in this country? Did we see a lot more women flyers? Did we see people opening doors for women?
Oh, yes. Yes. And at one point she was she worked for one of the early airlines because there were so many people afraid of flying that they wanted her to be as visible as possible, because here was this 5'8", 118 pound, you know, very rather slender, unprepossessing physically woman, and here she could handle an airplane, and she could fly, and she could do all these things. So she could encourage the American public not to be afraid of flying and to take their first flight.
Mm-hmm. And let's go back to George for a moment. What kind of, was George a PR agent for her as well?
Yes, he became it. He was a great many things. He was a promoter. He worked for the for Hollywood, but while they were married, and for the until she went missing, he basically devoted himself to taking care of her, promoting her, organizing her business interests, which were extensive. So that's what he did.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere I read in the last couple of days about a conversation that Amelia had with Gore Vidal, in which she was talking about her anxiety before this last flight. Was there anxiety?
Well, yes, but not really serious anxiety. No, I mean, before every flight, before every adventure, I think everybody always has second thoughts. But she didn't even think that the Pacific, which was, of course, her Donnybrook, was that she thought flying over Africa was going to be more difficult. And she had a navigator with her. It's the only flight that she ever took where she wasn't her own navigator. And Gore Vidal and she were great friends, but she was great friends actually with his father. He was a boy of 10 at the time when she took this flight. But ever after it, I mean, he had a wonderful comment. Gore Vidal had this wonderful comment about her, which was, this is basically after she made her solo transatlantic flight, because she was the second person. Nobody had been able to make a transatlantic flight solo between her and Lindbergh. And after that flight, he said of her, and ever after, he said, forget Garbo, forget Jackie. She was in a realm beyond stardom.
Hmm. That's quite a comment. I'm thinking about what the navigation equipment must have been in those years. It can't have been very sophisticated, was it, Susan?
No, but, I mean, for her day, she had she had the latest, the first radio direction finder put in a civilian plane, and she thought, I mean, you know, by our standards, it was inadequate, but she thought, and other people at the time thought, that it was state-of-the-art and that it was going to take her to Howland Island. If she could get on the beam, that it would be like a homing pigeon. It would take her right to where she was going.
We welcome more phone calls. We're talking about Amelia Earhart this hour of the program because this is the week, 75th anniversary of her disappearance, her plane's disappearance, and there is yet another expedition. This one is pretty sophisticated and fairly well-funded. It's the Earhart Project, and they are on their way. They just left on Tuesday of this week from Honolulu. They're on their way to the island of Nikumaroro within the Republic of Kiribati, where it is believed that the plane is. I didn't realize that if you go that far down, the plane, because it's 17,000 feet, did she say, would be pretty well preserved because it wouldn't have rusted. There have been other expeditions. Susan was on one of these, but we're looking at the entirety of her short life and remarkable woman. And because this is the 75th anniversary, there is an exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery. There's this expedition going on, and there's interest in following, which you can day by day, this expedition that's going on right now. It's the Earhart Project. Susan Butler, author of East to the Dawn, The Life of Amelia Earhart, which was the basis for the 2009 film Amelia. Here's our phone number. Join the conversation if you would like. I'm sure some of you are fascinated by her story. And Susan spent 10 years writing this book and got a lot of information that nobody else has ever been able to get. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Or you can go to our Facebook page if you would like, and that's the Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program, we're going to spin some tunes and talk about music of summer. We mark our lives by music, and we mark our summers by music of the summer. We'll have three guests with us, a music critic for the St. Petersburg Times, a contributing editor and music columnist for Esquire, and the music editor for Milwaukee's Shepherd Express. So we'll be hearing some of the songs that we've made popular over the past 40 years, and listen, of course, to part of the Song of the Summer in 2012. Two more phone calls now for Susan. Let's go to Gary in De Pere. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I heard once where, maybe this has been brought up before, I just tuned in, where there was a naval transmitter out there in the Pacific that was off because they didn't replace a dead battery, and that this could have been critical in their movement across the Pacific. Is that true?
Yeah, yes, that's probably true. That was the Coast Guard boat, the Itasca, was waiting at Howland Island for her. Also a measure of how important she was in the world at the time. And there was something the matter. Actually, nobody knows whether the fault was with the airplane transmission or whether the fault was with the transmission on the Itasca, but communication just wasn't working between them.
Yeah, thanks.
And how did the world respond to the news of her being missing, Susan?
Oh, well, the world was stunned. I mean, everybody was stunned. It was like everybody stopped doing whatever they were doing when she went missing. And President Roosevelt responded by sending a fleet of Navy ships out to look for her, including just about the largest aircraft carrier in the fleet. Her going missing was just a stunner.
Mm-hmm. And was it surprising that they couldn't find any traces all those many years ago? Wouldn't there have been something? You would think.
No, actually, I don't. I don't, because I mean, if she had landed on an island, yes, But if the plane had just crashed into the ocean and broken into pieces and the pieces had sunk, no, I don't think that it was surprising.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I understand, you know, one of the problems with the Pacific, because of its vastness, is people literally run out of gas. And, you know, if you get disoriented, or is that sort of the underlying working backwards, that that's what happened to her?
Oh, yes.
The plane most likely ran out of gas.
Yes, but the fault was not, the fault was with the planes of the day. She was going for Howland Island because the planes didn't have the range that they have now. And the range of the Lockheed Electra that she was flying was 4,000 miles. And that wouldn't take her from Ley, New Guinea to Hawaii. So she had, Howland Island had been picked as the refueling place and had been developed by the U.S. government. And they were, that's where her gasoline was waiting for her to that the plane could be refueled.
Hmm. Thanks, Andy, for your call. Elizabeth in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I was just calling to say that I've read Miss Butler's biography, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's beautifully written. I highly recommend it to anybody who's interested in Amelia Earhart or that period of aviation.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that there were several things that I was surprised by Earhart's character. I mean, I knew she was probably pretty, I mean, she's obviously very courageous and adventurous and personally ambitious, but I was surprised by how much, I mean, she did have some larger societal concerns, which came out in her, in the social work that she did early on, and then later on, her willingness to spend an enormous amount of energy promoting aviation in general as a commercial enterprise. And but the quality in her that I think I was most struck by was just how calm and steady she was in high pressure situations. And I think the of all her flights, the one that I was most impressed by was that first flight when they were stuck. I believe it was up in Nova Scotia before they. They were waiting to get clear weather to go over it, the Atlantic. And she, just her ability to stay so calm during the day after day of waiting. And I mean, I would break under the pressure. And I'd, you know, just her ability to that even keel of staying so calm in those situations was really, really remarkable.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think you put it beautifully. She had that. She had that sort of basic calm and basic competence that she could sort of deal with everything.
Hmm. And how did she promote aviation as a commercial enterprise?
Well, she just was always talking about how safe aviation was in the first place, because people were afraid that they were going to fall out of the sky and die. And so she would say that the most dangerous part of a flight was driving to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
She saw the future of aviation as we see the future of astronauts. It was just the next step. And she was there to show people that it was an easy step and that it was necessary.
She would have been the first female astronaut, too, wouldn't she?
She would have been, yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you, Elizabeth, so much for your call. A couple lines are open. 800-486-8655 is our number. Betty in Oak Creek, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program, as usual. I often wondered if they have... I know she's from, I think it's Omaha, Nebraska.
No, she's from Atchison, Kansas.
Oh, she's from Hutchinson?
Atchison.
Atchison, that's right.
Atchison.
Do they have special days honoring her famous?
The whole town, in the first place, her childhood home there is a museum. But
oh, my goodness.
The whole town is like a tribute to Earhart.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Has the exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery opened, do you know, Susan?
I don't think it has.
Yeah. That will be nice.
I think it's going to be wonderful.
Yeah. Tell me about your interest in her. To spend 10 years on somebody's life is an incredibly long period of time. What kept you going day after day after day on this? Was it your family's early history in flying, or was there something about her that was so extraordinary that she was more worthy of your time than anybody else?
Well, the deeper I got into it, really, the more involved I got, because the deeper I got into it, the more I saw what an unusual person she was. And then, as I learned more about her, I wanted to learn more and more and flesh her out. And I didn't, my object really after the first few years was to write a biography which put her, gave her the authority and the dignity and positioned her as this serious American woman that she was. I mean, she was sort of much more than a pilot. She was sort of an icon. She's become an icon, and I think maybe I contributed a little bit to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was my goal.
What did you think of the film?
I thought the film was terrific. It wasn't a great commercial success, but I think they did a great job on it.
Uh-huh. And do you think in your lifetime that this is all going to be settled? Because there's a big part of the story. We want to know how things end, and we haven't known this for years with her. Do you think that we will know?
Well, I do, but, it's very expensive. Now, I was told that our search, the Seward Johnson search of the west side of Howland Island cost $12 million. God knows how many millions it's costing Tiger, and he's done a very good job raising money for all his expeditions. But I think it's simply a matter of time and money. The plane is at the bottom of the ocean. As I said, the oceanographers tell me that because there's no oxygen at that level, the plane looks pretty much the way it did when it sank to the ocean floor.
Mm-hmm. And how does she speak to people now? Do you think that we study Amelia Earhart in schools? Is there something that she says to young women now that is timeless, Susan?
I do. I think that's part of her appeal is that she does have a timeless appeal. She transcends her age. If you look at pictures of Earhart, they could be a picture of a woman walking along the street now.
Yeah.
She wore pants. She wore turtleneck sweaters. She wore casual clothes. She looks contemporary. There's sort of an ageless look about her, which I think that's true of all great people, actually. They stand out of their time.
I think you're absolutely right. There is that ageless quality. I had the great pleasure of going to the Air and Space Museum a couple months ago and was just captivated. I spent the longest time in the room that was dedicated to Amelia Earhart. It was absolutely wonderful.
How great.
Yeah, it was great fun. Well, I thank you very much. I hope that something comes from this. Are you following this expedition pretty carefully? Do you go to their website every day, or do you have other things going on?
Well, I do look occasionally, but I do look occasionally. I mean, I do. I don't want to get left out, but but to tell you the truth, it's been so long. It took me 10 years. The book was published in 1997. I have been through an awful lot of searches.
Mm-hmm. Are you working on another biography, Susan?
No, I'm working on something totally different now.
What?
I'm working on a book about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin.
Oh, you are? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That is quite different. Now,
quite different.
I would have thought maybe you would have chosen Eleanor Roosevelt. But
yeah.
Well,
I got interested in Franklin Roosevelt, and I'm doing the relationship he had, and he had one with Joseph Stalin.
Uh-huh. When will that be released? Do you know?
Probably in 2013.
Okay. Well, Susan, thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest, Susan Butler, this hour of the program, and her book is East to the Dawn, The Life of Amelia Earhart. It was the basis for the 2009 film Amelia and Susan spent some 10 years of her life working on this. Now, we do want to remind you that if you're really interested in all of this, you can go to this, isn't this Modern World something? You can go to this website and get a day-to-day update of what's going on with this Earhart project. The expedition left Honolulu on July 3rd. They are at sea right now. And they're going to be going to where they believe the plane went down some 75 years ago. So go to that website and you can find out what's going on with it. It's a fascinating story. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this hour. And thanks to Brett Jaspers as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where it's very hot. But it's very hard where you are, too, I'm sure. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio. And then we're just going to have a bit of fun the next hour. We're asking you to think of the summer songs that you remember during the course of your lifetime. And we'll talk about all of them after the news.